All right, a couple of other introductions. You may have already met her this morning, but in case we have new people in this session. Before joining the Obama administration, Nancy Sutley was in L.A. serving as Deputy Mayor for Energy and Environment, represented Los Angeles in the Metropolitan Water District Board. You know that significance of that very important organization. Used to work for Governor Gray Davis, did policy at the California EPA, after working at the big EPA during the Clinton years. Let's welcome President Obama's chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, Nancy Sutley. Now, this summer, I don't know why, but I did, rode 505 miles across Iowa on bicycle. And there were two wonderful highlights. One of them was Johnny Carson's birthplace in Corning, Iowa. I got to pose next to a cardboard cutout of the great man. And the second highlight on the last night was cruising past our next panelist's house in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. Tom Vilsack is the former governor of Iowa, and I had never met him before about 3 minutes ago, but I have a buddy who does know him, who's a CEO of a, I think we'd all agree, very socially responsible large company. And I asked him last night about Secretary Vilsack, and this is the email I got back, and this is sort of almost the tragedy of Twitter. I noticed that the response I got back was precisely 130 characters. The person who knows Secretary Vilsack wrote, "Vilsack? High integrity, strong character, track record of successful public service, ability to bring people together, and his particular charisma is his passion for democracy." Count it, it's 130 characters. He went from town mayor, state senator, to governor, the first Democratic governor, you will recall, in Iowa for 30 years. During his years as governor, he was very big on alternative energy and has, as we'll see, strong views on the work that the USDA does in the fight against global warming. Let's welcome the United States Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. And we're violating format slightly. I did want the Secretary to just take a few moments to let us know what's up over at the Department of Agriculture. So my leading question is something like, by my count, you've been over there a little over 8 months.
Right.
Anything different?
Well, when was the last time an ag secretary came to this event? that we are making an effort to make sure that people in this country understand that the USDA is an everyday, every way USDA. Most Americans do not understand or appreciate the full breadth of what USDA does. In the area of the environment, we have been quite active. We have begun the process of working with Nancy and other members of the Green Cabinet to support President Obama's efforts to really bring meaningful climate change legislation to the fore, to get America in a leadership position. I think there's an expectation worldwide that America will, in fact, lead on this issue. To do that, I think we need to have the framework that the President has laid out, and we're actively engaged and involved in advocating for that because we believe that it, in the end of the day, it's one of the best things that could happen in rural America. We think an offset program will encourage additional land practices that will be beneficial not only for the environment, but also for the farms and for rural America. We've been actively engaged and involved in making sure that people understand that the Forest Service is, in fact, part of the USDA. Not too many people outside of government fully appreciate or understand that. They usually think it's part of the Interior. I myself learned something very significant my second day on the job. I was at the Interior Department or the Forest Service Department, and I was shaking hands with folks as they walked in, indicating I was a new employee at the USDA. I wanted to meet my fellow employees. They all thought I was had no idea who I was, and they, you know, it was a Tuesday, and I was happy, and they weren't particularly happy. And young man came up to me, and he finally figured out who I was. He said, "Sir, would you mind coming over here to the display here?" And so I walked over, and there was this very large bear. He wanted to have my picture with his large bear. And I said, "Oh, this is great, Smokey the Bear." He goes, No, sir. I said, "What do you mean, no? That's Smokey the Bear. That's Smokey the Bear. We all know who Smokey the Bear is." He says, no, sir, it's Smokey Bear. Most of us make that mistake, and so I want to make sure.
Oh.
It's not Smokey the Bear, it's Smokey Bear by law. That got me interested in the Forest Service. And we, in all sincerity, we really have begun an effort to try to create a new approach to maintenance and to the care of not just our national forests, but also our state and private forest lands. We think there is a tremendous opportunity for an improved effort there that will not only enhance them as forests, but as importantly will allow them to do what nature intended them to do, which is to act as a reservoir and a holder of water. The scarcity of water, the issues with water are immense. We have not been properly maintaining our forests. So we have approached it in a restoration mentality, looking at this as an all-lands approach, encompassing crossing borders, trying to link what we do in forests with private working lands. And I have to say that I'm really honored and thrilled to have one of Iowa's best here today, my good friend Paul Johnson, who served as my first director of natural resources at the state, but prior to that worked at in Washington, D.C., in the Clinton administration, NRCS. And Paul, this is a man who really educated me about conservation, so I appreciate him being here today. And we're trying to continue our efforts with this forest project, with working on climate change. There's a variety of other things I could go on for a considerable period of time, but I was told that I needed to limit my comments, and so hopefully we'll get to the other issues when...
I love this guy, at least in terms of time management. This is fantastic. I'm going to come back to the climate change in just a second. You'll have more time to weigh in on that, but I wanted to get Nancy Sutley back involved. I got to ask you, sort of bluntly, what good could come of the Copenhagen summit if the U.S. doesn't go armed with legislation on climate change?
Well, you know, I think the U.S. is going to be in a very different position coming into Copenhagen than it was at Bali or at Poznan, and even going back to Kyoto. I think that it was very significant that the House of Representatives passed the Waxman-Markey bill. But even more significant is that the President of the United States has said, I want a bill. I want comprehensive energy and climate change legislation. And so, you know, I think it's going to happen, whether a bill lands on his desk before Copenhagen or not, it's going to happen. So I think the U.S. will be approaching Copenhagen differently. I think, as I said this morning, I think what we'll get out of Copenhagen is knowing what we need to do, and I think the world community accepting that this is a challenge that we have to address as a global community, and a much firmer set of instructions, I think, to the entire world, to the developed and the developing countries, about what happens next. And so I think I am relatively optimistic that both the prospects for energy and climate legislation are good, and the prospects for something meaningful coming out of Copenhagen are good.
The reason I ask is I was watching some of the statements of the man heading the Obama administration's negotiating team ahead of Copenhagen, Todd Stern, and he was sounding, he didn't sound desperate, but he sounded profoundly concerned recently. He seemed very worried about going into the final round with a weak hand because Congress is going to take a little while on this stuff.
Well, I think for the negotiators, obviously having a bill signed and in place is the strongest possible way to approach it. But I don't think it's really the only way. And I think that what the administration has shown is not only a willingness to engage on this issue, but a willingness to lead. And as I said, it is profoundly different that this president has said, "I want energy and climate change legislation." It is profoundly different that the Recovery Act has almost $80 billion worth of investments in clean energy, and it's different that the cabinet is working together in this way, not only to to move forward energy and climate change legislation, but also thinking about how it is that the government as a whole does things to make the United States a more sustainable economy, creating clean energy jobs that will have the effect of not only revitalizing our urban communities, but the rural communities, such as the farm we were just at, breaking our dependence on foreign oil. All of these things, we're all working together well, and it's not just the green agencies, it's not just Council on Environmental Quality and EPA and the resource agencies, but also across the government efforts to push ourselves and push the economy towards a cleaner one, which in the end is what we need to do to make a profound impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
You mentioned rural communities. Let's talk about climate change and your portfolio. I mean, you must be either directly or indirectly hearing from farmers about concern that if Congress passes this, farmers are going to have to pay more for energy. I mean, that's what I'm hearing from some farmers when I was riding bike. You have an answer for them, I think, right?
We do. And it's going to require us to repeat it over and over and over again for it to sink through. There are essentially three aspects here that folks have to pay attention to. First, farmers are concerned about fertilizer costs, the impact that climate change may have on the production of fertilizer. And what they are not aware of, at least with reference to the Waxman-Markey bill, is that in that bill there are certain allowances for the fertilizer industry that should prevent any significant increase in fertilizer costs associated with climate change for a good number of years as this process begins. In the meantime, I have no doubt that there will be adaptation and technology changes and better awareness and understanding of substitutes for petroleum-based opportunities. So I think their concerns as it relates to fertilizer may be just not knowing all of the details of the bill. The second thing they say is that we're very energy intensive, and therefore we will pay a substantially greater amount for our energy. That assumes, that, again, that farmers will not respond by figuring out ways to use less energy or by ways in which they can embrace renewable energy. We just gave over $100 million to a number of, I think it's, I'm going to get sure I get this right, right number here. $106 million to 1,300 farmers under our REAP program. It is part of the Energy Title of the Farm Bill, and it is a way of which we are saying to farmers, here are resources that will allow you to figure out the best way to adapt your particular operation to renewable energy sources. We just saw an example of that at the Cray Brothers farm that we just visited, taking manure, converting it into energy, and using energy to heat their office building and their supply store and providing additional energy for the community. So I think there will be adjustments and adaptation as well, but there may be some additional increased cost on the energy side. But what they are not understanding is that there is also, in Waxman-Markey, an offset portion. In other words, the capacity of farmers to be able to be paid for changes in their operations, adaptations, no-till, applying fertilizer at different times in different ways, different types of fertilizers, different ways to raise livestock, capturing methane, different feed ratios that might result in reductions in methane, forest opportunities on non-productive land, all of which could potentially result in additional income. So at USDA, we tried to begin the process of calculating, well, what could that additional income potentially be? On a fairly conservative estimate. And what we concluded was, in the short term, it was at worst a break even, and in all probability a slight increase in terms of overall money in the pockets of farmers. Maybe $1 billion to $2 billion more into the ag economy net. Over time, with significant resources and offsets, it could grow to as much as $15 to $20 billion a year. Now, to give you a framework for that, we are estimating that total ag income, net income this year, will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $55 billion. So you're talking about a fairly significant increase in the overall agricultural income in one fell swoop. And when you start taking that into consideration, you begin to have a slightly different attitude about climate change. And when ag is 7 to 10% of the problem and 20% potentially of the solution, there's an opportunity there. And I think we need to push the opportunity side of this better than we have.
When you were governor, you're very big on bioethanol. Still big on that?
I am. For multiple.
There's a person riding the gang a little bit, so maybe it'll...
Okay. For multiple reasons. First of all, I believe strongly in rural America. I believe strongly in rural America because of the value system it represents. I'll just give you one indication of what that value system, how you define that value system. Rural America represents 25% of America's population, but 45% of the people who wear the uniform of the military are from rural America. And so I think it is critical to the future of this country that we have a strong, vibrant rural America, that we reclaim our rural opportunity. Alternative energy creates an opportunity for jobs and creates additional markets. Now, if the question is, are you a great believer in corn-based ethanol as it's currently being produced, I think it's fair to say that we're going to transition away from the way we used to produce ethanol to a variety of new ways to take the residue from crops, to take grasses, to take woody biomass, to take... I've even seen a facility that's taking dried manure and converting it into ethanol.
All these things united around the same concept of stuff humans and animals don't eat.
Don't eat and are considered waste product and no value, considered a liability. We turn them into a potential asset. We create opportunities for farmers. We create jobs. Now, why is that important? Because unfortunately today, 55% of American farmers, when asked what they do for a living, do not indicate that they are farmers. And the reason they don't indicate they're farmers is because they have off-farm income. 900,000 of those farmers work at least 200 days off the farm out of 2.2 million. So roughly half of our farmers work two jobs. And more than half understand that most of their income comes from someplace other than the farm. So we have to change that dynamic if we want to continue to encourage our children and our grandchildren to have opportunity in rural America. So I think this administration is doing something that has not been done before. It is creating a new dynamic in rural America that has the potential to change the economy of rural America. When you take expansion of broadband, you combine it with the energy title of the Farm Bill, with the offset portion of the climate change bill, and what we last week announced, a program called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, where we're trying to connect local production more closely with local consumption. These are four cornerstones of a new economy in rural America. And I'll tell you, I've been in this business for a long time. This is the first time that I really sense that we can really change things in rural America.
Start queuing up your questions, if you have them. I'm sure you do. I'll just ask one more from up here, but let's get everybody ready. Tell me, Nancy Sutley, about environmental enforcement in this new administration. Somebody slipped me a question before I came here about Superfund cleanup sites and said that the media was happy to criticize the Bush administration for its low number of completions of Superfund cleanups, but there's concern about your number. You going to get in there and get more aggressive or when it comes to Superfund cleanup?
Well, I hope so. I think I think one of the things that I'd say that's for me exciting and
It's working now.
Exciting about being part of this administration is I spent a lot of my career at EPA in the Clinton administration and at the state level, and EPA sort of vanished for a while as it forgot about being the Environmental Protection Agency, and for both the new leadership at the agency itself and the leadership in the White House, EPA is back on the job. And I know you just heard from Gina McCarthy, and so in this 8+ months, I think there's EPA has done a lot, I think, to show themselves again to be concerned about public health and the environment. And I think we all believe, and the president believes, that we have to make decisions that are based on science and the law. And that would be the basis of how we conduct environmental policy, not based on ideology or politics. And, you know, it may sound a little silly, but when I got to CEQ, I pulled open my desk drawer, and there were a bunch of red pens in there. Because
really, and, not metaphorically, really.
No, they're right. And I got rid of them and told my staff, I don't want to see any red pens at CEQ because the White House should not be editing science. The White House should be helping agencies when they need help to make sure that they are making policy based on science and the law. And I'll tell you, we've had plenty of opportunities to do something different. And we have, I think, we have really focused on doing that. And then the other thing I'd say, just because I think the Superfund example is a good one, and we've again run into this, is that I know in Los Angeles, where's my home, that there are Superfund sites, massive Superfund sites that have been on the Superfund for more than 25 years. And they haven't been cleaned up. So in 8 months, I don't think that we necessarily should expect to be able to reverse 25 years of inaction in 8 months. And so as we look at environmental problems and environmental enforcement and enforcement of the environmental laws or meeting the goals of the environmental laws, in some cases, I know that the Forest Service has run into this. The Department of Interior, EPA, has is that you're dealing with sort of leftover decisions that were made by the previous administration, litigation that is in progress, and sometimes it just takes a little time to kind of put things on the course that we believe is the right course.
Now, as I turn it over to you, just a brief reminder: start your questions with your name, if you could. Short and pithy is much appreciated. Just a quick thing about that. I got a lesson in the short and pithy question that I just wanted to share with you all. I was a foreign correspondent based in London. The biggest story of the century comes down. Margaret Thatcher steps down after all those years in power. And the one person the media wanted to speak with was Margaret Thatcher. And there's the equivalent of Morning Edition over there on the BBC. It's the keynote interview of the morning. They get Mrs. Thatcher the morning after. So I start formulating in my head, had that been me, what would be my question? And I came up with this long dissertation that would have shared my wisdom about British politics. And this is what their wonderful anchorman did ask. He said, Mrs. Thatcher has resigned. Joining me here in the studio is Margaret Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher, what gives? I was like, I am not worthy. So if you can, keep them short. You get the point. What's your name? Well, I know you, but one more time.
Art Hacker, Wisconsin Public Television. One of our earlier presenters was a gentleman from Tufts University talking about per capita emissions of carbon per state. And at the top of the curve were places like Alaska, Texas, Kentucky, Wyoming, places that produce a lot of coal, oil, whatever. But mixed in with them was Iowa. And why does Iowa have such high per capita carbon emissions? Do you know?
It may be that many of its electric power plants are coal-fired. That's one possibility. I honestly don't really have a very good good answer for that, other than it is interesting that it would be in the top of the list because we have made a real commitment to renewable energy with wind energy. I think 6% of our overall power is generated from the wind. And at one point, we were number one in the country with wind-generated power on the grid. It is also, people might find this interesting about Iowa. Most people think of Iowa as an agricultural state. But in fact, there is more of its economy linked to manufacturing than agriculture in relationship to production and gross domestic product. So it may be a combination of more reliance on manufacturing than most people realize, combined with power plants that are either old or are inefficient or are coal-based. But honestly, I don't. That's just a I guess.
Sir, your name?
Rob Davis. I'm a reporter with voiceofsandiego.org. Secretary Vilsack, there's a story in the New York Times within the last 10 days about E. coli contamination in hamburger meat and the lack of safety regulation that is causing that problem. What gives?
Okay. you know, that was a very, very frustrating article to read, and the reason why it was frustrating is that the incident that it reports in the paper was the 2007 incident. And when we first came into office, one of the first things I did was to encourage the administration and the president to focus on food safety. The president heeded the call, was concerned about food safety. It was a result of the peanut butter issue. And we formed a study group, health food safety study group. Kathleen Sebelius, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and myself were named the co-chairs, and we were asked to put together an action plan for improving the food safety in this country. One of the first things we did as part of that recommendation and working group was to identify the need for us to begin checking for pathogens in bench trim. Bench trim is what's produced when butchers and processors are producing the more finer cuts of meat, and they're sort of trimming them, trimming the fat off the more finer cuts of meat. That is oftentimes used in part to produce ground beef. In the past, it was not being checked for pathogens in 2007. In 2009, is. We are in the process of a significant effort, both on the FDA side and on the USDA side, to improve the tools that we have for the identification of pathogens, for preventative measures, for higher and better worker training, more resources to look at areas of the food processing system that are, where you're most likely to have problems, and the capacity to recall mandatory recalls as opposed to voluntary, the power to recall when there is a product that is tainted or is causing a problem. We were also in the articles cited because the USDA did not in 2007 take any action to fine or punish the entity. The problem is we don't have any civil fine authority in the law, something that we no doubt will seek to rectify with legislation that we're proposing. The FDA is going through with its food safety legislation. Our expectation is that will pass this year, and the game plan is for us to follow it up. The reason why we didn't combine our pieces of legislation is that we actually are a little further ahead on this than the FDA because our theory was all was prevention, and we had a few more tools and a few more resources than the FDA. So I think we are working very hard to address this issue. I think we've taken some very concrete steps to do so.
Dan Sullivan, freelance writer, recently liberated from the Rodale Institute. I was wondering, Secretary Vilsack, if you could tell us what specific agriculture practices are going to be encouraged by the USDA and NRCS to sequester or at least not volatilize carbon, and how will that be quantified and rewarded?
We are in the process now of, and have been for a considerable number of years, taking a look at the issue of climate change and the way in which agriculture, the way in which we produce our agricultural products. The obvious answer to the question starts with no-till, starts with more active and aggressive use of conservation programs. We have seen the conservation ethic transition when Paul Johnson was, when I was first elected governor. Paul Johnson encouraged me to encourage the governors to have a meeting of all interested parties on conservation. And we saw at that time that the conservation programs were an important part of the Farm Bill, but they were an auxiliary part of the Farm Bill. This last Farm Bill, I think we finally saw that we were beginning to treat conservation like a commodity, in the sense that there was significant resources behind this effort. The Conservation Stewardship Program, we recently received a substantial number of applications. I think we have 12 million acres of of authority, and I think the applications represent about 33 million acres of possibility. So there's real interest now out there. So that's an indication. This Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food program, you would say, well, what's that got to do with farming and climate change? Well, we'd like to reduce the carbon footprint of how long it takes or how far it has to go, food has to go in order to get to a person's table. If we had smaller processing facilities, warehousing facilities, we wouldn't necessarily have to truck food 1,500 miles to get to folks. We will probably likely see increased investment in things like digesters that we saw today. We will likely see enhanced research on the feed that livestock are fed. There's a dairy operation in New Hampshire associated with a yogurt company that believes that they found a feed that reduces methane by a third. That type of thing would potentially qualify for offsets. It's difficult to say with precision today every single activity on the farm that will be rewarded or encouraged, but I do know this. I don't think there are any greater innovators or adapters than America's farmers, and I think you will see an explosion of new ideas occur. We just yesterday launched the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, a new research opportunity created by the Farm Bill. And I am encouraged by the fact that we're going to focus our research on things that have impact. And one of the things we're going to focus on is this whole issue of climate change, adaptation, and mitigation. And then there's a whole different answer on the forest side.
All righty.
Christine Heinrichs, freelance writer. Regarding the upcoming joint Department of Justice and USDA workshops on exploring the monopoly in agriculture and the solicitation by the USDA for other topics that the public would like to see discussed, another one, what gives?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, there's if you travel the countryside, I've had 22 town hall meetings in the last couple of months in 22 different states, talking to thousands and thousands of people in rural America. There are some people who are expressing concern, and I think with some justification, about the control of technology in agriculture. Relatively small number of companies having a significant block on technology. Is that a good thing, a bad thing? I think if you talk to small producers, particularly hog farmers, and some dairy operators, they will tell you that they're a bit suspicious about how open and transparent the market is and whether or not they can actually feel comfortable that the price that they're getting on the spot market is in fact a market price or is a price that could potentially be shaved and manipulated in some way. So the purpose of these hearings is to give people an opportunity to tell us the concerns out in the real world, so that the Justice Department, the USDA, can determine whether or not there needs to be further investigation, further review, or further conversation. What we want at USDA certainly is innovation. We want a livestock industry that is transparent and that is fair, that doesn't necessarily give a producer just simply because of size a significant advantage. And we think that they're we think that these opportunities will be interesting and things will come to light that perhaps need to come to light.
Nancy, something I want to just ask you something because I'm not smart enough to have come up with this question myself, but there was someone here who was. And I remember I had done some coverage about this about 10 years ago. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. During the previous administration, how a life was calculated and what it's worth to society if we could save a life through environmental regulation. They changed the formula. Comments on that and whether or not some of these formulas might be changed in a different direction under your watch?
Well, yeah, the for now more than 25 years, the federal government has had under executive order a process where regulations are being adopted would go through some interagency review and some review by the Office of Management and Budget
for cost effectiveness.
And so this started this has a requirement that agencies do these regulatory impact analyses, where they are doing things such as having to calculate the benefits of the costs and benefits of different regulatory approaches. And when you're talking about environmental protection, protection of public health, then as you sort of get into this question about how do you value a human life. I think that back to the sort of general principle that we should follow science and the law, that I think what we're going to have to do, and I think there are many people in administration who have thoughts and expertise and thinking more broadly about how we think about the costs of any particular way to protect public health and the environment and what those benefits are, because they had, it's been a fairly limited look, and certainly there are, particularly in the regulated communities, a view that you have to the benefits have to justify the costs. I don't think anybody wants to do anything that's not cost effective, but really to think more broadly about how we look at the costs and benefits of different ways of approaching what are serious public health and environmental challenges. So, somebody, not me, once coined the concept that you value human life differently, the kiss granny goodbye theory. I'm not sure we're going to go there, but I do think we have to take a broader look at what the how we think about benefits and how we think about costs.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Emily Main from Rodale. Also, this is sort of to either of you. I'm curious to know, as Gina McCarthy just said, that the carbon offsets that will be included in the cap and trade program are going to, they're going to start with the verifiable, legitimate carbon offsets. Are farmer rural digesters and the like going to be included in those initial offset programs? And if so, why? If so, why not?
It's difficult to answer that question because the process in the Markey bill essentially instructs the USDA in partnership with other federal agencies to really look at and determine what is in fact a credible offset, how to verify that an offset has occurred. I think it's a little bit premature for us to begin listing all of the things that will be offsets, because it will go through a process. Crop rotation, cover crops, digesters, as I said earlier, different feed ratios for livestock that could reduce methane, and a whole host of other opportunities in terms of forest and land conservation. Secondly, there are practices that may not potentially qualify for an offset, but could qualify for that portion of the bill that talks about enterprises that can't qualify but still are trying to do the right thing for the environment. Additional resources there. And then there are the conservation programs that currently exist. So folks who are looking for the definiteness, I think, first of all, we got to get the bill passed. Then we have to go through the regulatory process and the science process to make sure that we have the right set of offsets. And then why is that important? Because this is all going to determine whether the market for the system we're setting up, the cap and trade system, is going to work. If the market is manipulated, it's not going to work. So what I can tell you is there'll be a process, there'll be transparency to that process, there'll be a real thought behind that process. I don't know that anybody today should or could tell you with precision exactly what is or is not going to be an offset. But Nancy, I don't know if you...
Yeah, I would just add that I think that the most important thing is we need to get a price on carbon. I mean, right. We cap emissions and put a price on carbon. That does open up an opportunity to provide incentives for people to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions when they can do it cost effectively. And certainly there will be entities that will be covered under the cap, and there will be entities that won't be covered under the cap, but it doesn't mean there's not opportunity to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for the entities that are not covered by the cap, and who could potentially, and I think that's where the real opportunity for agriculture is, provide those carbon reductions at a lower price than some of the entities that are covered by the cap. But until we get to that point where we have a cap on carbon and a price on carbon, that we won't really be able to develop those opportunities.
Well, yeah, let me just give you an example. I mean, there's I mentioned earlier this facility in Virginia that's using dry manure to produce ethanol. One of the byproducts of that process is a grimy, gritty, black substance, which some folks would refer to as biochar. And there are many people who believe that biochar has two potential uses. One, as a fertilizer in certain circumstances, and two, with some degree of excitement, the ability to capture and sequester carbon and to lock it up for centuries. Now, you know, I have to think that the most important reason beyond the protecting the globe for this climate change bill is the need for America to have a new economy that creates meaningful employment and that allows us to reclaim an innovative edge. And I believe that's precisely what we're talking about here. I think we're just on the cusp of enormous innovation. How we produce power, how we use power, how much power we use, how little power we use, how we convert things that used to be waste, how we get away from pollution, how we get away from a petroleum-based economy to a much more bio-based economy. These are all exciting potentials for innovation. And there needs to be a push. And I think that's what this legislation will do. It will provide that push.
World's most patient man's name is?
Chad Cohen. I'm an executive producer with the Discovery Channel. More and more, it seems, there's food companies and supermarkets and big box stores that are telling us how much carbon is inherent in their products, and they're looking to do that more and more. We all look to USDA for our calorie content and our fat content. Do you think we might be able to look to you for our carbon content in our food products? And what would be the practical implications of that and political implications of that?
Well, the practical and political implications of it would be that it creates another set of data points for consumers to make decisions. I will tell you that right now, I suspect that the primary focus at USDA in terms of consumers and data points and information is to provide as accurate information as we can about the nutritional value of food. We have some serious issues here in this country relative to obesity and relative to hunger, and they need to be aggressively addressed. And one way to address them, but by no means the only way, is providing consumers accurate information about the nutritional value of what it is they're consuming so they can make an informed choice. I was visiting with a grocer the other day who is interested in having in his stores a program that basically values each product on a 1 to 100 scale, with 100 being the most nutritious and 1 being the least nutritious. He has begun to experiment with this system, and what he has found is that within the cereal area, shredded wheat has become a significant seller for him. A product that people are purchasing in far greater quantities than before. Why? Because it's a 99 on this scale of 1 to 100. Hmm. And so, you know, that type of thing, I think, will move consumers. Now, whether it will be USDA or the Energy Department or the EPA or a combination or a new agency, that I don't know. But I will tell you, our research right now is predominantly focused on nutritional value because, you know, 2/3 of our budget is in food assistance. And we can, I think, change the dynamic here by looking at the nutritional value of school lunches and school breakfasts in our SNAP program and our WIC program.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Townsend with KBIA. It's a public radio station in Columbia, Missouri. traditional agriculture seems to be very proud of the relatively low food costs that we have in this country, and also stakes its economic success on how much we can our exports to a great extent, how much of the stuff we can get out there. I was wondering, for both of you, what do you think the effect of this greater movement towards sustainability will have on food costs and farmer profitability?
And do they have to be opposed, the march towards sustainability, and will it, does it have to drive up food prices? One way to look at that.
Not necessarily, for the reasons I stated earlier. If, in fact, there's a $20 billion opportunity in offset opportunities by the use of farmland, based on the crops that you're growing, if, in fact, we create more local markets so that there is you don't have to truck crops as far, you don't have to process them and truck them as far, there's a substantial opportunity here, I think, to increase the bottom line. We are at USDA, this Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative is designed to expand farmers' markets, expand community-supported agriculture, address the issue of food deserts in urban and rural areas where they don't have access to grocery stores and therefore don't have access to wholesome and nutritious and balanced food. And we're aggressively promoting climate change. So, I mean, all of these opportunities, are, I think, are opportunities to increase the bottom line, not necessarily decrease the bottom line. And I think they have an opportunity to repopulate rural America. Now, why do I think that? Because if you look at the ag census that we just conducted, there were 108,000 new operations in America started farm sales of less than $10,000. Now, that's a very, very, very small operation, but what are they growing? They're probably growing fruits and vegetables, probably taking it to the local farmer's market. 108,000 in the last 5 years. We want to be able to figure out strategies to allow those folks to become mid-income-sized operations and encourage the next 108,000 to come out into rural America. Will we continue to export? Absolutely, we'll continue to export.
Food cost.
Pardon?
Food cost.
Will drive up food prices.
It shouldn't necessarily drive up food costs. The farmer doesn't really take much out of the food dollar today. That's one of the problems. If you take a look at what we're paying for, we're paying in some cases for fancy boxes and a lot of advertising. In terms of what the farmer gets, it's pennies on the dollar. So I don't know that necessarily what happens on the farm is dramatically going to impact the cost of food. But going back to this earlier question, the control of technology, the fairness of the market, the transparency of the market, maybe that might have that might help us drive food costs down.
I apologize for this, but we're down to the last question. It goes to you.
Molly Stentz, WORT-FM Radio. I guess I wanted to ask the man from Discover's question in a different way, and that is that several large food manufacturers plan to unveil carbon labels on their products, Tropicana with orange juice. There's a number of them. That is something they've announced coming down the pike in years to come. Is that something the USDA supports for the products under its purview?
Well, we regulate only meat, poultry, and processed eggs. Obviously, to the extent that consumers can make informed choices and the more information that they desire to have before they make that choice, we're obviously interested. That's why we were involved in nutritional labels. That's why we've got the food pyramid. And that's why we're very concerned about some companies that use the food pyramid to try to suggest, wrongly so, that their product is more nutritious than it is. So we are conscious of our information, our seal of approval, USDA stamp, being used to promote safety and security of a product or the nutritional value of a product. But we're obviously not going to be against people having information. We want people to have the right information. We want to make sure it's accurate. But again, I think our focus today is not so much on carbon content as it is on how much sugar is in it, how much salt's in it, what's it going to do in terms of calories, and whether or not it's wholesome and balanced food.
I'll just add, just on the information point, I think we've seen voluntary efforts to look at carbon, do inventories of your carbon emissions, California set up a program now going back about 8 or 9 years, and actually many federal agencies signed up to be part of various carbon emission registries. EPA just finalized its greenhouse gas emission reporting rule, and we, as part of a new executive order on sustainability within the federal government, have been developing tools and measures so that federal agencies can do inventories of their own greenhouse gas emissions. And I think it's the point that the more information helps helps everybody to make better decisions. And so there's real opportunity through these kinds of tools to help people make better decisions. And a little anecdote, I was in a well-known grocery store chain in Washington, D.C. recently, and there were, you know, 16 different types of apples, and including some from New Zealand. And I started to reach for them, and I thought, well, wait, why am I buying an apple from New Zealand when I can buy one from Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, that's a very good point. You see, really, I think our focus is more on location. I think more people are interested in knowing where their food came from and what's in their food. And that's really where our focus is.
So another successful broadcast. We haven't libeled anybody. We have used very little profanity, and we're getting off exactly on time. For the two people who are left standing, I apologize for that. It has to do with air travel schedules, that we're being so ruthless about time. So let's thank the panel, Secretary Tom Vilsack and Nancy Sutley, the White House Counsel on Environmental Quality. Thank you.
Thank you.
Over to you.